The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right. Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And today we are talking about The Rock on TIJ as my good friend and Black Veil Brides frontman Andy Biersack returns to pull back the veil on the Bride's new album, Veil. It's out now, and Andy thinks it's the best of the band's career. Of course, every band says that, but you'll find out exactly why Andy thinks that. He's also sober and living a healthier lifestyle these days, which is one of the reasons why he loves the record so much. He's talking about what inspired him to give up the booze-ski and start working out and eating better. He's sharing stories from some of his drunkest moments on stage and in the studio, like the time he mooned the audience at the Download Festival and the time he jumped off a statue during a gig at Hollywood and Highland in Los Angeles. You can actually see that online. He actually broke his ribs, but he finished the show like a true rocker. And he's also a diehard Kiss fan. We both love us some 80s Kiss and some 70s Kiss. And he's got some thoughts on Gene Simmons' new Vault release, his favorite Kiss lineup of songs, and the Kiss video that terrified him as a child. You'll find all of that out coming up right now with Andy Biersack. Great guy, and he returns to Pull Back the Veil right here on TIJ starting now.
So it's been a couple years since I saw Andy Biersack, who's about 4 inches taller than you were from the last time.
And
you
said I had surgery.
You did?
Yeah, the leg stretching surgery.
Yeah. I got shin implants.
I cut it off right at the knee, and I put somebody else's leg who's slightly taller.
Either that or you're wearing Paul Stanley boots.
Yeah.
Funny quick story. I text you and said, come on up whenever you're ready. Yeah. Knock on the door. I let loose with a big, oh, yay, I got some good-looking girls. It was the maid asking if I wanted some water.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When you came back the second time, it wasn't.
It was just the one. But I will say that there's it is a uniquely specific thing to our friendship of liking Kiss that I knew for sure I had the right area when I heard a Paul. Like, there's not really many things in my life where I would knock on a door and then hear a Paul Stanley voice and be like, I've met the right place.
Unless you're actually at Paul Stanley's.
Sure, yeah, which is not, you know, not something I do. Yeah.
It's a funny story. So I just told this to Scotty, and I was at his house earlier today. So when the fires are going on, I was texting my friends, making sure that everything's cool. Paul's one of the guys I text. And I'm like, hey, man, like, you okay? And he's like, yeah, we're fine. You know, I was a little bit freaked out watching the TV. But then I called the fire station, and they said it's okay. I'm like, firehouse.
Oh, you got so close.
It's gonna be firehouse. And I want to say, did you mean the firehouse, Paul? Yeah. But I'm like, he's probably going to say, fuck off, dude. I'm going to burn here. And you're gonna give me a kiss.
Do you think he said firehouse to one person that called, and then he's like, I can't do that. I have to specify station from now on.
I know at one point in time I sent something along the lines of like, we'll work it out. It's as easy as it seems, or something like that.
Sure.
I'll see you tomorrow. We're going to fall in love. Nothing.
Yeah.
I don't think he likes getting those
I was going to say, if he liked it, you could have just gotten into a where all your conversations are nothing but lyrical.
That
like,
should be
build nothing but every possible way you talk to him, you try to fit in a kiss lyric.
We should do that one day, just like you and I have a conversation where we use nothing
but kiss lyrics. It's possible. When you have 900 records over the course of 150 years, you can definitely do it.
Yeah. Have you listened to the Pod of Thunder podcast?
No.
So you got to check this out. It's really cool. So it's these three dudes from the Chicago area, and they do one show per song.
Okay.
So they have.
You told me about this.
Yeah. So it's just like they've been. The reason why I thought of that is because you mentioned, they got 900. These poor f***ers have been doing this for, I think, 4 years now.
Yeah.
And they're still not done yet.
Yeah.
They've still got another 50
songs. It's going
to
go on forever.
you know, if they
because now, you know, with Gene's like box set, they'll have to do all of those. It's going to go on forever.
Forever and ever. Yeah. Are you going to buy the vault?
I don't think I'm going to get the vault, but I will be curious to know what's in the vault. You know what I mean? Like, apart from, like, I know that there are certain songs that I'd love to hear the demos for, but you know, as a musician, like, demos, it's sometimes like you almost don't want to feel the level of attachment to someone else's like beginning of their work. But then on the other hand, you know, as a fan, you certainly want to hear the derivation of everything. So I'm a little bit split on it.
Well, and the thing is, like, I had him on and he was impressed. So he has the vault with him. And this thing, it's like a road case.
I imagine he carries it at all times right now. It's like when he had the Kiss phone case and he would show it and everything.
This is different. This thing is huge. It's like a road case.
Yeah.
And you open it up and it's got this book inside of it.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know how big it is. It's got 200 pages, 500 pages, but it's like a big coffee table book.
Yeah.
And the book alone was like, okay, so the vault is $2,000. I paid, how much did you pay for, did you buy Kiss Tree when it came out? I think I paid like $500 bucks.
It's pretty expensive for a book situation.
Yeah, but it's got, and then it's got 150 songs. And just goes.
I didn't get the monster book, though.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
I stepped out of that.
Yeah.
You know, but it does have the Van Halen brothers playing on Christine 16.
Yeah.
Like those sort of things. And then it's got a little tidbit, like a little souvenir from his collection. So this one had like a scarf and like a fan painted Gene Simmons mask. So you get that sort of thing.
Well, you know, I've probably told you, I know that there's a certain element of the Kiss fan base that doesn't like the action figures and all the like kitschy accoutrements. I love it. Like the tiny Gene, that was the first thing that I talked about when I saw it, was like, well, now there's a Kiss figure that I have to find a way of getting because,
The Gene Simmons.
Plain clothes Gene Simmons.
With the sunglasses.
It's like when I was a kid, I wish that they had made a plain, I don't know why, I wanted a plainclothes Bruce Wayne action figure so bad because in my mind, like when I was like five, I could have done like, now he's about to get into the suit. And I remember I had one where he was like, it was the mask would come off or whatever. And that was the coolest thing for me. So as a little kid, if I had my Kiss figures and then I had Gene like not in his makeup, that would have been the best.
Very cool. But even I like the idea of the a Clark Kent doll. They never sold those.
No.
They never sold Batman plane.
Because the concept of Clark Kent is stupid in general.
Put the glasses on.
Yeah. I mean, it's too hard for me. Like, there's no suspension of disbelief for me. If you have any amount of being, like, analytical and watching it, you're like, nope, that doesn't work.
You could at least put, like, one of the Groucho Marx, like, nose and mustache glasses.
Sure. I wish that would have been – isn't it a shame that we didn't develop Superman? Because if we could go back in time and have Clark Kent be essentially just Groucho Marx and then at other times, he's a hero now, but
I'm just laughing at the fact that thinking back that you actually stopped me from creating a Paul Stanley smear job when he stood me up on the podcast, which stood me up. He didn't do it. And I was like, we should put together one of those things where he used his audio and I asked questions and we just bury him. You're like, dude, stop it.
To this day, though, I mean, now you're friends with him, so it's a little bit different. But if that had not happened, I still feel like it would be a funny thing. But you wouldn't want – now it's like you wouldn't want to offend your buddy.
No, he's always my friend. But I was I think we even got to the point where, like, you know, you were like, what, you just want to kidnap him? Take him out of the parking lot and beat him up?
Well, there's so many – like, to go back to, like, the fact that there's so many songs, there's so many audio clips. Obviously, the let me get this off my chest thing that everybody's heard. Like, that's – somebody – you know, I think it's funny because being a huge Kiss fan, obviously, like, you know everything about Kiss, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're familiar with everything. It's very rare that you find something that is new to you. And because the internet has allowed for people to find stuff that maybe they didn't know about before, buddies of mine who were kind of like ancillary Kiss fans will find things like the Let Me Get This Off My Chest YouTube video and send it to me like, dude, you got to see this. And I feel like the most kind of like over it guy of like, I've known about that for you. I had the cassette, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I want, I guess in some ways, it's very interesting to think that there is this band that, you know, obviously we bonded over that and many other things, but there's this band that has stood the test of time so much that there's still new information and new fun things that are coming out.
Multi-generational, too. It's interesting. I think I might have told you this, and if I didn't. So I took my son and his friend to Kiss last year.
Yeah.
And it was like was it Moline, Illinois, or it's one of those places.
Yeah. As you do.
As you do. And, you know, I mean, it's the constant, you know, what's the best lineup? And you and I are very – we love the Revenge era.
Sure,
and so I take them. And, you know, people complain about, you know, well, Tommy Thayer's in the band and I wish he wouldn't wear the makeup. Listen, those kids watched Tommy Thayer and walked out of there going, Tommy Thayer's the greatest guitar player in the world because he shot the bombs off and he had the fire and he played the solo and, you know, the whole deal. And to them, Tommy Thayer is their – Ace or they're Bruce Kulick or that, you know, I just like Paul always says, wherever you get on the KISS elevator and whether you ride us all the way to the top or you get off, we're happy you just joined us for a little bit of the ride. I just saw that like, wow, like these kids have no idea who Ace Frehley is. The spaceman to them will always be Tommy Thayer.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I hear that and yet it's still so hard because like I'm someone who is not original four only guy, right? Mm-hmm. Because I grew up in the 90s. And for me, that was an entirely different era. And so by the time I came into the KISS fandom, my kind of association with the band wasn't necessarily the original four so much as it was I got in right before they put the makeup back on, right? Like as a hardcore fan, that was when my fandom started, right, with Revenge. And so I saw the original four as the ones with makeup. But when I was a kid, I thought, well, I suppose Bruce could put on the makeup. You know what I mean? Like it didn't register. But now that we hear all this talk about KISS 2.0 and all that, I admittedly, as much as I say that I'm one of those guys who's not original four only, I can't see the band without Gene and Paul. And I think that's because of my age and my perspective. I wrote a book and I'm almost done with it, just kind of about like my life. And it's not a memoir because I'm 27. You know what I mean? It's just like stories about growing up in the Midwest and trying to be a rock star and kind of the funny stories and stuff that happened.
Some great ones.
Yeah, it's just a collection of funny stories and stuff from my childhood. But I did a significant portion of the book about KISS because it is such an important part of my life. And I kind of realized while I was writing it, like the artistic significance of the band and how weird it is that there isn't as much credit or I guess integrity that is put on who they are because of the makeup and everything else. But when you consider the fact of how odd it is at the time, yes, there were precursors. Yes, there was Alice Cooper and stuff, but it was such a odd and innovative thing. That is why it's carried on, and that's why a young kid who knows nothing about anything that has to do with the history of the band doesn't care about 1975, but is still interested in it because it's this really cool visual and this odd thing. Right now, as it stands, it doesn't stand to reason that a bunch of men in their late 60s can stand on stage in Halloween costumes with things blowing up around them and entertain a child. We live in the era of iPhones and iPads and all this other stuff. How is it that can still catch the attention of a young kid? And so it's kind of an interesting case study that I don't think many people dive into, is this kind of cultural significance to the band.
It always kind of makes me it's always interesting to me that you talk about, okay, Andy Biersack from Black Revised and Chris Jericho from Fozzy or a wrestler guy or whatever. There was a time when people went, Andy's in a band? That's never going to work. Or Jericho wants to be. I always like thinking back to 1974 when KISS shows up in those costumes. I bet you people were laughing.
Absolutely.
Look at these idiots. Yeah. And if you and I were sitting there in 1974, we might have been thinking the same thing. Until you get over that hump where it becomes cool, you really have to be focused on your vision. That's what I love about Gene and Paul and why they're so successful as yourself and for guys like us. Because once you become successful doing something that everyone thought you would never do, then you become dangerous.
Sure.
Because now you have the confidence to go, okay, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to start a movie. I'm going to go, you know, make my own pinball machine or whatever it may be.
I always say, like, I always think of the first rehearsal for a lot of bands, like when they first all got together. The two that always make me laugh when I think about is the first show where the rest of the band saw Mick Jagger. They're like, that's what you're going to do? Like that?
Good call.
The dance thing? That's like, okay, cool. Like before it was Mick Jagger, right? Like there had to have been a moment where guys are like, for real? Like that's it?
That's awesome.
Or the first time, like Guns N' Roses is in a room for the first time. And then Axl starts to sing and they're like, that's the voice you're going to do? That like falsetto, crazy, screechy thing? And then it becomes, I mean, I'm not criticizing it because those are two of the greatest things in rock music history. You can't deny that. But at the beginning, it fascinates me, the idea of like,
it's a great call. It's like, you know, and if you have that confidence in your abilities, I just think from my own experience, like when I started wearing a scarf.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so stupid. Now everyone wears a freaking, I have a headband on now. If I was on TV, there'd be fans wearing headbands.
Of course.
There already is. They come to sign these because, oh, Jericho's doing it.
Doing the headband.
But you really have to be, like that Mick Jagger thing is so great. Can you just imagine, like, what are you doing?
Yeah, they're just sitting there like, what?
What?
What is this?
What is,
what is the pouting, the lip? Why? Like, because, you know, it's not like there was a conversation. I very seriously doubt that he sat and said, hey, I'm going to pout my lips out and walk like a chicken across the stage. Yeah. So just be prepared for that. It was just something that happened and then he carried it. And now it is quintessential rock and roll frontman stuff, you know.
Absolutely. I was watching the Live Aid, and my favorite gig from that, and probably one of my favorite gigs of all time, is Queen.
Yeah.
And Freddie, at one point, he's wearing really tight, like light blue 80s jeans and a white wife beater that's super tight.
That's exactly what I'm wearing right now for the listener.
And at one point, he just turns his back to the crowd and bends over, like touches his toes. So he's basically just bent over with his ass, just pointed at the crowd. I'm like, I love that. Like, what balls? I'm just going to bend over and moon the crowd with my jeans on. Let the crowd can just bang me up the ass. That's what I'm saying.
I have unfortunately not, I took my jeans part off. The first time we played Download main stage, I drank a lot back then. And I was like, I'm going to, well, my thing was I challenged, because, you know, you get bottled when you, especially if you're a young band that's playing at a high up, you know. Okay, so European festivals, it's not uncommon for particularly young bands that are maybe kind of, you know, not necessarily, most people that are there to see the monsters of rock, right?
Yeah.
If you're playing on the main stage and you're new to that scene, it's very common to kind of be, you know, people will put you in your place. And so we went out there and we had all of our makeup and crazy stuff. We had costumes made just for Download. And it's like, I had a horsetail and a big feather armband and I'm wearing like this crazy stuff. And we go out there and, of course, like half a second into the first song, it's just a parade of bottles that are coming down. And I was like, well, what can I do that will be a moment that no matter what, it shows a certain level of humility and also says F you to the audience. And, you know, not necessarily the audience as a whole, but the people who were throwing stuff. And so I went down, and one of my favorite photos is, it was the moment that I realized I have no butt. Right. It was when, because I never thought about it. Right. And then I saw this photo of me at the end of that long, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, there's a long kind of one of those narrow middle stage things that the singer can walk down.
Ego ramp
way out into the crowd. So I'm at the end of that and there's photographers all on the other side. And the next day I look at the photos and I'm mooning, you know, 100,000 people and it's just no butt. It's just back into legs. And I'm like, it's weird that that's the thing I took away from it the most. But now it's a photo of like, wow, I should really, you know, I should do some squats or something.
I think when you're like a girl, like you see that girls like probably like for some reason looking at their ass, but it's the other thing a guy does.
I had never thought
you
about
never
it.
Realized that.
And it's fine. I went back to not caring. I remember that moment. You know.
I remember Triple H years ago, Jericho's got a muffin ass. I'm like, what? Do I? He said, you got a muffin ass. I never thought about my ass before. Yeah. Like, do I have a nice ass? Like, you know, I don't
know.
The key
is, are your legs falling asleep on the toilet? If the answer is yes, then there might be an issue. And that is, for me, been the problem for, you know, if you have to use a butt pillow when you're sitting in traffic so your legs don't fall asleep, that might be the problem.
I love it too that you show up like super tight skinny jeans on and I think your legs are about the size of like the bottle of vodka right there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just all legs. It's like I was designed by Tim Burton. It's, you know, like
I said, it's the one from Willy Wonka where the guy gets stretched out and just kind of wanders.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that you were moving.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny that we brought up the monster book because I literally thought as I said it, man, that would have been a pain in the ass to move because it's like 90 pounds.
It was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had a situation where it wasn't necessarily any kind of danger, but my wife and I, our home address somehow wound up online, and we started getting a lot of, like, at first it just started with nice gifts and stuff. You know, people throw stuff over my fence, and it would be whatever, Batman, whatever. And then it started to kind of be people standing outside a lot and people taking pictures with our mailbox and all that kind of stuff. And then it kind of culminated in three people that came from another country and were out in our yard. And one of them was claiming to have a significant injury and all they needed to do was to come into my house. And I kept trying to call an ambulance for them and they would say no. And then it was just this big dramatic thing. Yeah. And so ultimately, what wound up happening was that suddenly the injury went away, and then they followed me like around my house, and then they trailed. And I just thought, you know, I tour a lot. It's not really in my best interest to be in a situation where my wife's home alone and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's weird because it's a really hard thing to tell somebody without sounding like a jerk. I mean, like, I'm so famous, I need to move. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really not it. It's just that there's a certain level of security that comes from knowing that maybe you're in a little bit more secure place. And I'm not saying that even the people that came and did the kind of, you know, skit on the front yard or whatever. And I'm not even, maybe there was a legitimate thing. The fact that it was going on and that they were adamant that, oh, Andy, I need your phone number and all this other stuff. Like, it starts to become problematic to where you're like, maybe we should go to a different place. And not because I'm above human interaction, but because there's a certain level of security and kind of like,
absolutely,
I like to keep to myself. So, yeah, so because of that, we just thought, you know, we were thinking about moving for a while, and it was just kind of the like, well, you know what? if we're going to do it, let's do it now. Let's find some place that's a little bit more kind of secluded and nice. And we found a great house that we love. And so mm-hmm. it's just the biggest thing now has just been it's kind of been a pain in the butt to move.
You don't realize how much shit you have until you move.
Yeah. My garage has been the worst. So when we're done here, I got to go back to the garage in my old place. By the way, this is the most annoying part, is living in the new place. And being, it's been now a week of us living in this new place. I have to keep going back to the old place because there's stuff there that I just want to get rid of. So like a garage full of crap that I don't need mm-hmm. that I'm just going to donate because there's no reason to bring it to my new place. But I've had to schedule getting the guys there for the St. Vincent de Paul donation people or whatever. I just, you know, a lot of old furniture and stuff that I don't want to throw away. I'd rather donate, but I just don't need. So going through boxes of stuff. And what I found was drunk 20-year-old Andy did a terrible job of like cataloging nostalgia. So going through my garage, I was like, this is stuff I need to have in my life. Like every laminate from every tour and all my stage clothes and music video props and all this stuff that it when I was just dumb and screwed up all the time, I would just throw it in somewhere, you know? Yeah. So the one thing that's really been good is that I've kind of been able to like put together a nice collection of stuff from my career that as I get older, I'm happy to have, but I didn't even know existed in there. So it was kind of like a nice little surprise.
It's funny when you find boxes like that. Like I've had a few of them in my house. I'm going to try and clean this up. And it's like, I could just throw this entire box away because I haven't looked in it in 3 years.
Sure.
I'll never know what's in there. It doesn't matter. But right before I throw it away, I'll just see what's in there. And then Next thing you know, dude, it's an hour late. I'm like, well, I got to keep that. Yeah. And get rid of this. And I got, like, instead of having the box thrown away, I've got half a filled box now.
Yes. And that is exactly what occurred. It was supposed to be an hour of just making sure that everything was good to go to get donated. 4 hours later,
yeah.
I was hauling boxes from the garage into my old house that are now just in the living room. And I don't, the new people are taking over the house on Monday, which we've met and is nice and everything. But now I have to get everything out of there that's just like boxes of stage clothes, leather pants, and, you know, all this like stuff. It just, with for the uninitiated, and I don't, you know, it's not like when I am going to hand the keys off. By the way, I'm a rock musician, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if they were to walk in at any point, because they have access to the place, there's just piles of what looks like Kiss costumes everywhere. And, you know,
S&M. Leather.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's this guy into?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, this is Chris Jericho inviting you to the first ever Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Picture this: rock and roll, wrestling, comedy, live podcasting, all on the open ocean from October 27th to the 31st, 2018, from Miami to Nassau. I'm bringing Hall of Fame wrestlers, some of the greatest rock and roll bands on the planet, and putting the first wrestling ring on a cruise ship ever. Don't be a stupid idiot. Make the list. Check us out at ChrisJerichoCruise.com.
You've mentioned it a couple times. I think I read it on your Instagram. You mentioned the drunk Andy and your screw up time. Have you quit drinking now?
Yeah, it's been about 2 years.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
And you said you're 27, so
yeah.
25, you quit. That's really young.
Yeah, you know, it just, I realized when I was really, when I was very young, I struggled a lot with anxiety and kind of issues of like, I wanted to do stuff all the time. And if I wasn't working and I wasn't doing something, I would start to get really kind of like spun out and feel weird and crazy. And so one of the reasons why I've always been so prolific and doing so much is that it's really important to me kind of for my mind to just keep going and doing stuff. You know, I think a lot of creative people are like that. And I realized that I was using being drunk more often than not as a way of kind of like quieting myself down, which when I first started drinking heavily didn't seem as an issue. And then it became, well, now I can't not go on stage drunk because I'm better when I'm drunk on stage, or I can't do anything without being drunk because it's easier and I don't listen to all the voice. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy, essentially. Right. I'm telling myself that I can't do this stuff without drinking. And then, you know, I had a lot of weird stuff when we made our second record. It was our first major label record. You don't realize, if you're an adult talking to somebody who's 19 years old, you don't realize that maybe what you're saying could affect them. I had the producer, who's a very nice guy, but he said kind of offhand, you know, I had been drinking all day that day. And he said, what's different? Your voice sounds crazy. You got like a lot of emotion in your voice. And I said, oh, I'm fucked up or whatever. And he goes, that's good. You should do that every day. Like, you should always get drunk before you record. And so that became in my mind, like, oh, that has to be that way.
Crutch,
like,
right?
Yeah. Like, so now I have to do that. Well, then I have to do it live. And, you know, just made for, I was never someone who couldn't stop. I was never someone who couldn't, like, I wasn't like shaking if I didn't drink. But when I would drink, I would often black out, and then I would just feel terrible about myself, and then the whole cycle would start over again. And it was just, you know, it was a way of a coping mechanism that I was using incorrectly. And it kind of all came to a head where by the time 2014, early 2015 rolls around, like, I just wasn't healthy. I mean, I just wasn't. I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't eating well. I was doing no form of exercise or anything. I was essentially, like, they call it, you know, the skinny fat thing, where I was
skinny,
like, skinny guy who was just, like, kind of, like, retaining water and, you know, getting no nutrition. And it just kind of came to a head where I just wasn't feeling good. I looked in the mirror and just said, like, you kind of suck right now. Like, you got to do something. And summer of 2015, we did – Blackfield did Warped Tour. And I said, you know what? I'm gonna try to do this whole tour without drinking. First tour I'd ever done since I was, like, 19 without drinking.
Wow, and that's a good 3 month.
Yeah, and it felt great. I was like, oh, I look cool again. Like, you know, like everything. I feel better. And then it became, well, maybe I should cut out some of the crap in my diet. And then that became easier. And then, you know, I had a few slip ups every once in a while with drinking. But then after that, really after, I would say that after my wedding was the last time. And it was literally the last time I drank. Was, I believe, I had some wine or whatever right before my wedding, and I was like, yeah, this doesn't really even, it doesn't do anything for me anymore. And it's not, I don't have that perspective of any kind of judgment towards any of my buddies, because, you know, I'm in rock and roll. Everybody, it's a party world. I get it. Mm-hmm. But for me, stepping out of that and kind of making my life and world smaller and focusing more on, like, my own health and feeling better about myself, I think it made me better. I think it made me a better lyricist and better artist. And I think that this Blackfield record is better because it's the first Blackfield record I've made since we were on a major label. Like, I mean, of the five records, it's the first one that I really was 100% sober, present, and not drunk while, you know, singing. Right. Mm-hmm. On the last one, we did it with Bob Rock, right? And I was so entrenched in the idea of, like, rock and roll and being a, you know, rock star and tragic rock guy who's going to drink a whole bottle of red wine just to write a song, that it's not that it's not a good record. It's just that I feel like when I listen to it, I could have done better because I wasn't really putting all myself into it.
Right.
So that's really it. You know, and as it is now, I feel great. And, you know, I try to work out every day and be the best version of me I can be, because, look, we are very fortunate as entertainers that the people are interested in what we do. And I was squandering that by not being good to myself, and therefore not really, I missed a lot of opportunities. I feel like between 2014, 2015, there was so much that I could have done that I didn't do because I was busy being a screw up.
It's interesting because it's a rare thing when somebody just takes themselves out of it. Like, usually it's rock bottom. You have to go to rehab because you're, you know, you're out of your mind. And yeah. But you just made the conscious decision. And I know you follow wrestling. I don't know if you still follow now, but Jinder Mahal made this transformation where he just became this muscle guy.
Yeah.
And it started because he got fired, and then he came back and he was like not really doing much. He stopped drinking and really concentrated on the diet. And as a result, they ended up putting the title on him.
Yeah.
But you and him are very similar in that. I can't think of too many people that just go, I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
Not that you're forced to stop or you have to stop, you're going to die. It's like, I don't like this version of myself.
Absolutely. And I have a lot of friends who are less fortunate in the way that they, you know, really got to that point, you know? And I saw that, and I just thought, you know, I've never had, like, I haven't, this is my second day since I was about 13 that I haven't smoked a cigarette.
Today?
Yeah. I realized yesterday that it was 10:30 at night, and I thought, I haven't smoked at all today. And I've been trying to cut down on that because I've been a pack a day, pack and a half a day guy since I was like 13, 14 years old.
As a singer too.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And it was just, you know, it was the last, when I stopped drinking, that was the last thing, right? That was like the, like, I'm still, I was smoking more to kind of like compensate. And, you know, and then my wife, she also cut it out, you know, no drinking. And so both of us are just became chain smokers, because now that's our one vice, is that we're both out there. And we had, you know, we'd go out on the porch and we'd have a couple cigarettes and we'd talk about something or whatever, you know, whatever it is, just kind of passing time. And it became so kind of normal that it started to get to the point where I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm you know, I'm at a point where I want to be a better singer. I want to have more stamina on stage as a front man. I'm trying to get healthier in every other way. Why am I still doing this?
Probably the worst of the worst.
Yeah, this is like, why am I doing this thing that I know doesn't end well? There's no success stories. There's not a person who was doing kind of bad and then they started smoking and everything got better for them. You know what I mean? Right. So it's like, it's completely, it ran counter to every kind of logical decision that I try to make. So I'm, you know, they say you shouldn't announce when you're mm-hmm. trying to do something, but I've been cutting down. I'm not saying, oh, I'm done. I'm saying that for me, it's really cool because I realized that I had gone more than 24 hours without even thinking about it with smoking. And, you know, I started using the kind of like the e-cig thing. Yeah. And, you know, I know people have all kinds of opinions about, oh, it's worse for you than cigarettes. To me, it's just, if I can get without the tar and all that stuff right mm-hmm. now, and I can just get by to where I don't need any of it at all, that would really be the best. But it's kind of hard to do all this and also not make your audience feel like you don't care about the kind of rebellion and angst that you've always felt. And it's a really difficult tightrope. And I hope that this is why I try to put it out there, is that I hope that people understand that the feeling of, you know, sticking it to the people that mess with you and the feeling of youth and rebellion is the thing that attracted me to rock and roll, not the feeling of screwing up my own life. And I got a little bit confused about that along the way because it started to become kind of one of the same.
Hand in hand in a lot of ways if you allow it to, right?
Yeah. But I still feel, if not more now, because I'm more myself than I was when I was on all the booze. You know, like we did that. I just look at like the times that I was awful on stage and I just think, man, I blew opportunities. We did a tour with Avenged Sevenfold years ago where I could have gone out every day and tried to really entertain the audience and to really give them the best show. And instead, I got really drunk and tried to fight everybody in the crowd all the time because I was mad that they didn't like my makeup or my costume. And instead of playing 10 songs, we'd play 7 songs because half the set is me calling out some guy. And all the, I mean, obviously the Golden Gods and all this other stuff.
Were you drunk, you know? Then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know.
Classic story. We actually talked with that Josh Bernstein. I did a Loudwire podcast, and that story came up, how hilarious it was.
I mean, look, the feelings behind it were legit. I wrote the song about my grandfather, and I'd written a speech I was going to give, and it's the wrong place for that.
Yeah, there was a guy in the crowd that was heckling you, and you unleashed the fury on him.
Because I was so mad. I was like, man, I want to tell this story about my grandfather just passed away like 4 months prior to that I wrote the song about, and now I can't do it because you're yelling at me. And
see Gene a couple weeks ago in Providence, Rhode Island?
No.
So hold your thought. So just to segue in this, so my friend Brent Fitz plays drums for Gene now in the solo band. So they're in, I think, Providence, and the mayor of Providence is going to give Gene like a proclamation, you know, like his key to the city or whatever, on stage. And he's telling the speech, and there's a guy in the crowd going, "Shut up! Play some music! Shut up!" And Gene's
"Who is that? Where are you? Up there? Hold on, sir." And he walks off the stage.
And Gene's like 9 feet tall.
Sure,
he's got the big helmet hair and the shades. He's walking, and some guy's filming. He walks by, his head and shoulders over everybody. Apparently, he walked right through the crowd, walked up the back steps, walked up into the balcony. And I don't know what he did to the guy. I don't know if he smacked him. I don't know if he got in his face. But then about 5 minutes later, he comes back down, gets back on stage, and goes, "Please continue, sir."
Oh, my gosh.
So there you go. You're not the only one.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the thing, though, is like that stuff like that is funny. But, you know, personality-wise, what I realized about myself is that if you and I build anything together, we got Jenga blocks sitting on this table, that kind of thing, I can work with you, but I have this, and I think a lot of front men are this way, I have this thing where my version is probably, in my mind, going to be a little bit better than yours. And so no matter what, we're going to keep trying to make it just a little bit. I'm going to keep putting one more on top to try to make it my version. That's something that regular me can kind of curtail and realize, hey, Andy, kind of being a jerk.
Yeah.
Drunk me is just autopilot, like, and if it doesn't go exactly the way I want it to, everything's going to blow up. And that's not entertaining. That's not the show that people deserve. And that's not what is why I started the kind of idea of this band and why I wanted to talk about being this kind of different kid and why we went so far in the direction of the costumes and makeup and why I wanted to – we would get up – we would do radio shows and get up at 6 a.m. to do a radio show that no one's going to see us, but would get in full makeup and costume and everything because I wanted to elicit that. We know that we're kind of the rebels and we're different. And I know that you're going to look at us in a certain way, but our music and our message and everything is maybe going to win you over. And if it doesn't screw you, we have this army mentality. That's what matters. Not me being a drunk jerk yelling at somebody who doesn't like my band. So it's really just about I know some people will look and go, oh, he's soft now because he's not drunk all the time. But I think in my mind, at least how I see it, it's I'm trying to give everybody a better version of me and not a jerk that's going to ruin their time.
Well, and it's like you said, dude. I mean, it's very rare that, the story ends well. Because if you're talking about drinking on stage and drinking in the studio, like I drink a lot, but I never, and I'm not saying this A, B, C, or D, I never got drunk on stage or before a match or anything like that. And it seems to me when you get to that step, now, what's to say that you're not going to, you know, have a drink when you get up in the morning? I don't think at 25, 27 years old that drinking and getting drunk ends well as you get older, because you probably just increase rather than stay the same.
And I was breaking bones on stage all the time. I was doing all kinds of stupid stuff. You know, I have
jumping
nothing
off the
but
dam.
Scar tissue on the lower part of my body here. 9, 10, 11, I don't have an 11th rib. It was just
that
broken.
You jumped off the balcony.
Yeah.
And hit the, oh God, I forgot about
because
that.
Because I was, you know, I wanted to.
Oh, dude, that was awful.
I wanted to do something that I thought was entertaining, but I didn't have the dexterity because I was a drunk mess. So, you know, like you want to try to do something that's fun and cool. Well, me now, I would say, you know what? Climbing up there, I could do other stuff that's entertaining.
Is that on YouTube?
Yeah, it's terrible.
You guys got to look it up. He jumps off the balcony. You hit a road case right on your rib, and it just like ricochet you.
I hit real quick, an abridged version of this story, right? Drinking all day, doing promotional appearances.
Where was that?
It was so Hollywood and Highland, the big open mall area. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, there's, you know, like where Ripley's Believe It or Not is. And it's like the center of
Dave
Hollywood.
And Buster's there now or something.
Yes. Yeah. So there's this big open mall. And at the top of it are these weird statues of elephants and stuff. And so we're doing an open concert on Hollywood Boulevard, open to the public. There's tons of people there. It's a big moment. And I go, song one, moment one, I want to do something that is crazy, that's going to blow these people's minds. And so me, in cowboy boots and nothing but marble pillars around, decide that I'm going to try to climb as high up as I can towards those elephants and jump off and land on the stage magically, and it's going to be amazing. So I get about 30 feet up, and I realize this is not happening. Like, and I have no way of getting down because I just climbed up, and I'm in cowboy boots with no traction on slick marble surface. So I just sit down, and then I'm like, well, this is not cool. Maybe I'm super strong. I wasn't. Maybe I can just take my kind of arms, and I put them behind my back, almost like I was going to lift myself up, you know, kind of using my wrists. And I thought I could catapult myself using nothing but the strength of my incredible wrists down 30 feet. And I would somehow land like, you know, imagine like a backwards L. That's how I thought my body might land. What really happened was, of course, you're top heavy, especially, you know, when you're doing that. So I just tilted the other way and fell just completely down, landed about 15 feet down onto another marble pillar, smashed all the ribs on that side. And then the security guard who worked there didn't know what to do. He's not trained. And he thought, well, the guy's doesn't seem to be breathing. I'll do CPR. So he starts crushing. And I can hear like someone stepping on bubble wrap my bones. And I can't breathe. And I'm going, please stop. And he's,
dumber.
Oh, man.
Pills are good.
And I got back on stage and finished the show. I don't remember it.
So yeah.
And so that's like stuff like that is like, nah, I'm good. I'm good. Yeah. Moving forward, like it used to be the joke with our fan base, like Andy would never finish a tour. I'd get hurt or get too sick or whatever else because I was drunk
all
the time.
In Britain or something like
in
that?
In Luxembourg, I fractured my skull from right here to the base of my nose, which made me look like I had a crazy like robber's mask on. there was just all kinds of stuff.
I remember chasing you down the middle of Sunset Boulevard when you were running around going like, anarchy or some shit. Like, get over here. And I remember I had to pick you up. And I was like, oh my gosh, he's really light.
Yeah.
It was you, it was you, me, and Danny Warsnop.
Yeah,
he's also sober now, maybe.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is Danny and I are going to go, I don't know if he, I know for a fact that he's cut down a lot, if not sober. I know
not
that he's, you know, really changed.
Was, right.
He may be. I'm not sure. We haven't, he lives in somewhere, I believe he lives over like towards Nashville area
now.
But so we're about to go on tour together in a few weeks. So it'll be very interesting for us all to get back. Because, you know, for our era of bands, I don't know that in our scene there were bands that more like partied crazy with alcohol and, you know, all that stuff than us in Asking Alexandria. We were kind of like, you know, we wanted to be the 80s glam rock bands, and not in a tragic, you know, dark way, but in like a fun, we're all having fun.
Roll,
we wanted to be the fun guys. Mm-hmm. And so it'd be very interesting with everybody kind of in a different place in their life to see how it's going to go.
I love you guys are sober teetotalers in their 27.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you live, I think the thing is that you don't need to be at a certain age to have said, maybe I've done enough of that. You know what
I mean? The thing is, when we're on the road, like being road dogs, you live multiple lives.
Yeah.
You know, we live, you know, we do more stuff in 27 years or 47 years for me that people do if they're 47 or 77.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think it's hard living. And if you're drinking as much as you did, 27 or 47 or 60, it's a lot of alcohol.
Absolutely.
And sooner or later, you know, it's not good.
Well, you know, and it just doesn't even jive with like what my heroes were. Gene and Paul were my biggest heroes.
Right.
And I just, when I was a little kid, I just thought, I want to be like them, you know. And you've never seen Gene a drunken mess anywhere, you know. And
right.
For all of his stuff, I'm not talking about maybe any other personal stuff that he has going on or whatever else. But just in a level of presentation of like being on stage he's always been a pro and given a show that you is worth seeing.
Yeah.
I can't say that I've always done that and I don't want to be that way. If people are paying money, particularly in this economy, in this day and age, people coming out to a rock show to watch 70, 80 minutes of a band playing on stage at a local house of blues near them or whatever, like they're worthy of a show. And at this level for us now, we have bigger venues, we have bigger staging, and yes, there's all kinds of cool stuff going around, but it's up to me to sound good. Because like the one knock has always been, oh, they're cool, but like Andy can't sing very well live or all that kind of stuff. And it's like, the truth is that, yeah, a lot of that is true. I wasn't really living up, because in my mind I thought, oh, I sound amazing.
Of course.
But in truth, I sounded like a drowning frog or something, you know? And I want to give a good show, and I want to do my best. And I think that, you know, I've just been given such a cool opportunity. I get to make rock music for a living in 27. That's like, it's such an archaic and odd thing to say because of the way the world looks at rock music. I mean, we know because we're in the scene that we're in, right? But some of the world they see rock music as 100% nostalgia based and not a current, thriving,
right.
Pumping
thing. Totally.
We know that that's not true. And I just feel lucky to get to do this. So why would I screw that up by being like, oh, I need whiskey all the time to be a cool guy. Like, it just
that's what rock and roll is.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Asking Alexandria, and you did a movie with Ben,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
American Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, a friend of mine, actually, you've been very gracious. His daughter is a huge Andy fan, huge Black Veil Brides fan. You've had him.
Yeah.
Come to the show. His name is Ed, and he said, we watched American Satan, and he was really good.
I'm glad to hear that.
He said, the only thing we didn't understand is why they overdubbed your vocals.
Well, so...
And I was like, okay, I'll ask him.
Yeah, so it's kind of a two-part thing.
First, tell us about the movie.
Yeah, okay, so the
movie
was, it's kind of interesting. When I first came here in 2005 to Los Angeles, and I went to a performing arts school in Cincinnati, and I was a drama major. I acted first because when you're 15, it's very hard for people to take you seriously in a rock band. So I thought, I need to be on stage. I need to entertain. What can I do? I can act, maybe. And so the way I auditioned to get in school is actually kind of funny. I didn't have a monologue because I didn't know anything about acting. So I did a dramatic reading of Dig Up Her Bones, the Misfits song, as my monologue audition.
Brilliant.
To get into the school. So they would send talent scouts to the school on a pretty regular basis. And they picked me as like kind of the weird kid that maybe they could find something
Cincinnati?
With. This in Cincinnati, mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in the Midwest, particularly in the early 2000s, it was like all TV was about Midwestern, you know, kids that have that Midwestern look.
Yeah.
And so obviously I didn't have that because I was wearing eyeliner and had black bangs in my face and everything. But they thought, he's kind of weird and has something about him. Maybe we can get him in something. So I came out here and I started getting like roles as like the drug addict guy, right? Because I was skinny with,
in
you
Los
know.
Angeles.
Yeah, so I did like commercials and stuff, like PSAs. I did an anti-meth PSA that's out there. And so I started having a little bit of success doing it, and then I went back to Cincinnati because I couldn't really be out here for very long. And but it was always something that I thought, man, one day I'd love to get back to that. The band was always my first thing. When I got back home, I really kicked into high gear with Black Veil, and it became a big thing. And then ultimately when I came back out here, it was like, man, I'd love to have that opportunity. And I would tell friends of mine this, and people that I kind of knew this. Well, one of the people that I've worked with for many years is Ash Alvinson, who is hugely into film. Obviously, his father was a director of Rocky and Karate Kid and
right,
so many other
John
things.
John Adelson.
Yeah, yeah. And he's always wanted to kind of get more into films, and he has run Sumerian Records for years and years, the label that signed so many artists. And I've worked with him. He was actually my first booking agent many years ago.
Yeah,
and
Fire is on Sumerian Records.
And so we've always been close. We haven't worked together in a lot of years, but we're kind of like, I consider him one of the first people that really got behind me and wanted to be a supporter of Black Veil. And so we're not on Sumerian, but they have black belt plaques in the Sumerian offices and stuff, because we were kind of like the honorary Sumerian band, because we were on another label. We were already had a contract when we met him, but he just really loved and got behind me. So it was always kind of like a thing where he's like, I want to get into films, and I wrote this movie, and I think you'd be great, you know, and it kind of like went around a little bit like that for that. And then maybe summer of 2015, he was like, we're going to do this, you know, we're going to make this movie, and here's the breakdown, and here's the script, and it all just kind of came together from there. And he literally, I mean, look, the character's name is Johnny, not Andy. He comes from Columbus, Ohio, not Cincinnati, Ohio. And he moves to LA to be a rock star. And that's kind of where our similarities end, in that he went down the path of, you know, meeting Malcolm McDowell and selling his soul and becoming...
Oh, so it's a horror.
Yeah, movie. Yeah. And so he meets Malcolm McDowell, who's our devil.
Badass, by the way.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And Malcolm was so great. So he sells his soul to the devil and becomes an internationally known star, gets really bad, ends up in jail, all kinds of stuff, big drug addict. Gotcha. There's a lot of me doing very bad stuff in this movie. And it was just amazing. But the reason for the vocals being different is that kind of two things. I'm under contract with Universal Republic. In order for me to sing on something, as you know, with labels, like, they have to give their okay.
Right.
Even it's, people don't necessarily understand that, like, the label, they don't own me. But when it comes to me singing on something, because I'm under contract, two contracts. I'm Andy Black and Black Veil Brides. Like, I'm double strapped down when it comes to that. They kind of have to have approval. And that would have been an unfair burden to have to place on Ash in the movie of, like, hey, you got to buy my vocals from the label or whatever. So... early on in the process, he had signed Palais Royal, who are a great young band that I actually had taken on tour around the same time. And the kid's voice is amazing, really cool, interesting voice. And it just seemed to fit. And the more I listened to the songs and the more the movie kind of came together, it seemed like, oh, this is great. Like, you don't want to watch Johnny in this movie open up his mouth and sound like me. Because I have a very specific singing voice, right?
Yes.
So it's like...
very recognizable.
If you're a fan of me, you want to be able to have the suspension of disbelief. And I felt like if I opened my mouth and sang like Andy from Black Veil or whatever else, it would take it away. So it served also for me, just like as an inexperienced actor, to do it and go, this isn't me. I have to remember this isn't me. And then it made me kind of want to do different stuff on stage, different mannerisms to what I do. And I think it all worked out great. I know some people are like, oh, why is he singing? Why isn't he singing or whatever?
Well, that makes perfect sense. And actually, I understand what you're saying too, from a character standpoint. You're playing this character, but if it's you singing, that's going to take you out of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Because, you know, when you're doing it, it's like a music video. You're hearing the playback.
Yeah, sure. That's what you're going to try. Do you want to do more acting?
Love to. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it was just, I will say that artistically, it came at the right time for me, too. I was in the kind of period where Black Veil was going on hiatus for a bit. I was just about to ramp up into the Andy Black thing, and I kind of just was home, and it was a really nice way of, like, my first project kind of in this new lease on life that I had, and being able to – it didn't hurt that I was able to work, like, 5 miles from my house every day and drive back home at the end of the night and be with my wife and animals and then get up in the morning and go work again, and, you know. But it was weird, man. You know, places that you and I have hung out in Hollywood, being there at like 11 a.m. with the sun out, you know, like you don't want to be in the rainbow at like 8:30 in the morning with the sun out eating breakfast. You don't want to eat breakfast on the stage at the whiskey with everybody else in the crew. So because we shot at all these places, and it gave me a very eerie, like, you don't see the walls in those places. You know what I mean?
I just did a shoot for Access TV in the daytime in the whiskey, and you're right. It's not meant to be there in the day.
You're not supposed to see everything.
Yeah, it should just appear like after 8 o'clock.
Yeah, there's a certain like cloud of darkness that surrounds it that is supposed to be there. And you're walking around all day. We'd be shooting in the Roxy in these locations. And you're like, I've never seen it. I've been in here a million times. I've never seen it. Like, what is that?
There's like some kind of a, there's like some kind of a mural on the wall of the whiskey, and I'm like, I never even noticed that before.
No,
I've been here 50 times.
I didn't even know those booths were there in the back. Like, we shot a scene there. I was like, what is this?
And there's that side bar. I didn't know there was a bar there.
No one knows that.
I've played it 10 times. They never saw a bar there before.
No.
So, we were mentioning Andy Black and Black Veil Brides, and the new Black Veil Brides album is finished. So tell us about that, because you mentioned the last one was produced by Bob Rock, which is a big deal. Where did you go for this one now?
You know, working with Bob, I've said it before, like, and I told you this when we were working on it. It's one of the sweetest,
nice
coolest,
guy,
most interesting and storytelling people of all time. I mean, I told you back when we were doing it, it's like maybe 40% of every day would just be storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, and so I really enjoyed working with him, but one of the things that I really wanted to do was, we had done a record called Wretched and Divine, which the song In the End that most people know is kind of our
biggest hit.
we did that with John Feldman, and I had just worked with John doing the Andy Black record. And I think that there was kind of a general consensus in the band of like, we'd really like to go back and do something that's much more, I don't want to say dramatic, but something, it's not a concept record like that record was a concept record, but it's certainly more dramatic and big. And one of the things about the Bob Rock record was we're stripping everything down. We're doing a very basic hard rock record. And that's awesome and cool, but like one of the guys in the band, Jinx, can play every string instrument and can sight read, and I'm like, we're not utilizing this cool stuff that we have, and why not go back and do something that is kind of really more on the dramatic side? And so working with Feldy is great. You know, Feldy's one of my best friends, and the guys in the band love him, and really for us, the turning point in our career happened with him. The record that we made with him, and we made a documentary doing it, so fans have seen it, but for anybody who doesn't know about my band or me at all, the record that is kind of probably our most successful commercially was a record called Wretched and Divine, which is the one that had In the End, which is the song that most people have heard. That record was kind of a turning point for the band, and not one that everybody in the band agreed with all the time, because we went from making records that were straight up screaming, breakdown, screaming, chorus,
crazy solo,
wheedly solo, screaming, you know, chorus, you know, like really heavy metal Motley Crue. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of like, well, let's do a record that has a little bit more maturity. And that was the first record that I didn't scream. That was the first record where we kind of did a little bit more of, not necessarily pop, but a little bit more of a pop song structure. You know, every song wasn't 8.5 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Every song didn't have just breakdown, scream, guitar solo. So it wasn't like there was fights in the band, but it was kind of an uncomfortable period. And ultimately, it led to what was the most commercially successful thing we've done. And so by the time we did the record with Bob, we were all on the same page, and we were all so into it that I felt like it was maybe time to kind of reestablish ourselves in kind of the world of doing something that was a little bit more broad and big. And we really enjoyed it, man. We took almost 2 years to make this record.
I know, it's been a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun to do it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we can't do that every time, but we were given the opportunity to kind of like, we had put out 4 records and 2 EPs in about 5 years. It was time to not just crank one out. It was time to take our time with it. And I think it's really worked out.
That can really hurt you if you do that. I mean, I know even with the Judas record, we started writing that, I believe, January of 16. It didn't come out till October of 17. So it's almost 2 years. But I remember when Bullet for My Valentine did, was it Temper Temper? Is that the name of the record?
Yeah.
And that's when Matt Tuck was like, okay, dude, we're going to write and record a song every day.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. I mean, a song needs to be shaped and worked with and over. And I understand the concept of just getting there and banging it out, but I think that record might have hurt them because they were at a certain level and it didn't transpire. You got to be careful in this day and age because it's like David Lee Roth said more than ever, here today, gone later today. It's very easy.
Yeah.
You know, here today, gone later today. It's very easy to be kind of supplanted by somebody else or another form of entertainment.
Sure.
The way that people consume so much now.
And I think that one of the things that, and you know this when you're doing a record, is everybody goes in with a really romantic notion of like, I'm going to write 30 songs and we're going to pick the best one. We've done that. And what we wound up with was a bunch of B-sides.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's great if you want to release later an extra special bonus.
Black Bride's Vault.
Yeah. but it didn't feel necessary this time around. We did exactly the number of songs that are on the album, and we spent all of our time perfecting those songs. I think we maybe had 2 songs or 3 songs. I should be clear. We did more than just the number of songs that are on the record. We finished just the number of songs that are on the record. We wrote and thought, nah. You know, pretty early in the process. If something wasn't coming together,
why finish it?
Why finish it? Yeah. Which we've always done in the past. It's like, we'll just finish it because it'll see the light of day eventually, and we'll put out this EP of substandard songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the thought was just to do it because, look, I hate to be so, like, I don't want to, for anyone who doesn't know my band, they're just going to think this guy just criticizes everything that they do. I know when I listen to the previous record, and this is no fault of Bob's or anybody else.
It was just called Black Veil Brides.
Right.
What's this album called?
This record is called Veil.
Gotcha.
V-A-L-E. And that's Be Well, Be Strong in Latin. Mm. It's also like a form of goodbye. the idea is that we have done all these records, and I've just, for me personally, as we talked about earlier, it was just saying goodbye to all this stupid stuff that I had built for myself, all these kind of constructs that I believed. And then for the band, we're moving on. We're doing something new. We're saying goodbye to a lot of the kind of stuff that we believed we had to be, you know?
So this is not goodbyes and you guys, this is the last record.
No, I mean, I think one of the things that's great about the album is that it really, it feels like a nice send-off to the kind of like story that we had written in 2012. We did a concept record in 2012 and it didn't have an ending. Mm. And so the song In the End is this really kind of open-ended thing, and I never wrote a way of ending it. And we always said,
did you do a movie for it too?
Yeah, yeah. And there's no ending to it. And and I always said, oh, we'll do a comic book and that'll be the way it ends. Right. And so we never did that, and I thought, we need to finish this story. Right. And so that's really what it's about. It's about finishing the story, and this is not a goodbye to everyone, we're done now. Yeah. It's about finishing the story that we started. And so I think that fans are really going to like it. And obviously, you have a name like that, it stirs up controversy and people saying, oh my God, this is definitely the last record. But that's not the intention. The intention is to put out an album that we're proud of and that we hope people will like. But yeah, I forget where I was going.
We were just talking. You mentioned you were going to see some of the last record, the Blackville Blides record. Yeah. That it wasn't necessarily Bob's fault, but you didn't.
You wouldn't think that our name would give people so much trouble.
It's hard,
by the way,
it really three times fast.
Blackfield Brads is my favorite one. We had a guy
who said that
we
one
were in Seattle. A local promoter many years ago said, "You guys, the Blackfield Brads?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, we are."
Well, listen, I had Virgil, pro wrestling superstar, one, yeah. And seriously, not trying to take the piss. I go, "How's Foggy doing, man?" I like that Foggy. How Foggy doing? I'm like, Foggy's doing great.
Yeah.
So I think that should be next to Foggy.
Classic.
And the Bradfield.
Foggy.
And Bradfield, was it?
Bradfield. No, Blackfield Brads.
Blackfield Brads and Foggy coming to a veteran's hall.
It almost
near
just
you
sounds like a little bit of a southern accent on it. You know
it
what
does,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like Brads. So what I was saying is that the previous record felt a little bit like, and this goes to what you were saying about writing every day, right? We did the same thing. It started to feel like I was doing like Mad Libs of myself with the lyrics, mm-hmm. like taking things, not even knowing that I was doing it, but just taking stuff that I had already said and kind of placing it. I'm like, that looks like a Blackfield song. Let's record that. You know what I mean? And that's not good. You need to be able to write something that you feel is genuine.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing this album, and now it's been 2 years, is it exciting for you to kind of get back into that vibe? Because you mentioned there was a movie. There was a – has there been two Andy Black records?
There was one, and now I am maybe – what are we, 12 songs into the second one?
You're like me. You're working on diversity and building not just the Blackville Brides, but also the Andy Biersack, you know, brand.
I like to do stuff.
And it's great. And your podcast is great. I mean, you're perfect for it. I think I even talked to you about doing one a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But now, like, the focus of the what brought you to the dance is exciting to be thinking like you're going back into Blackville Brides.
Yeah, I mean, it's so cool. Like, I realize that we haven't been in a room together playing music in nearly 4 years.
What?
Yeah.
You haven't had a gig in 4 years?
The beginning, well, let's see. No. 3 years. It'll be 4 years since the last release. It's been 3 years since we've been in a room together.
Really?
Yeah. But
even making the record, because you did it all at separate times?
I'm just talking about
playing a gig.
Playing a song.
I understand.
All of us playing in a room, playing a set list together. Mm. I'm thinking more like, because we're going to, you know, we're about to start pre-production on the tour.
Yeah.
So we're going to be on a stage in a lockout space, you know, and people will be standing in front of us, adjusting lights, and we'll be playing like we're playing a show. You know how it goes.
Yeah.
That's going to be so cool. Like, I can't wait. I can't wait for us to be absolutely terrible for the first couple days and to figure it out again. Because you know how it is. When you've been touring on a constant tour cycle, rehearsal is just this weird moment where you're like, we know all this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get together and make sure that we don't screw it all up. And it doesn't have that feeling of excitement. And then the new songs do, right? So now every song in the set, you go, oh, well, let's play the new ones again. Can we play that new one again? For us now, after 3-something years, every song's a new song in the set. I can't wait to play Knives and Pens right now. Like, you know, all of it is really exciting. Like, I'm excited to see the dudes, and we're family. You know, it's just fun.
There's also nothing better than, like, when you do a record. Like, for example, I did my parts for this record January, February, March. And then it doesn't come out until October. And then you start rehearsing. And, you know, I don't remember how these fucking songs go or what the lyrics are, how I sang them. And the first time you play that new song, it's always, it's like a baby walking. It's always a little shaky at first.
Yeah.
and you might have a little bit of screw up. I always look at Rich Ward because he's kind of like the MD of the band. It's like, well, that didn't suck, or boy, that one's going to, oof.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
You have to play that 50 times more before we even think about doing it live. But once you get to that point, there's nothing cooler as a rock and roll band. It takes you back to when you were a kid setting up in your basement. You start playing, I don't know, You Really Got Me, or whatever the hell it was.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man, this is cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, lyrics, there's a tremendous amount of fear that goes into lyrics that I wrote remembering them somehow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think people don't necessarily know. Just because you wrote the song doesn't mean you remember what the hell you wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, there's songs that are 7, 8, 9 years old that I you know, it's so funny, the technology now. I put together a private Spotify playlist that's our set list, and I sent that to everybody. Usually, this is the first tour that we've ever done. Maybe this gives you an idea of how long it's been since we've toured. This is the first tour we've ever done where I didn't make a mix CD to give to everybody of what I think the set list should be. Because I couldn't, first of all, my laptop doesn't have that CD drive. I couldn't even find blank CDs. I looked at Amazon, and they're like $68 for blank CDs.
It's like, what are you doing?
And so I was like, I guess I have to use real technology. So I had to make a Spotify list of our songs. And, you know, there's...
Do you do that? Do you put together a list and then listen to it and see how it sounds?
In the car and stuff. There's some songs that I can't do that with because they're not out yet. So, you know, there's not... You know, the new stuff isn't on Spotify, so any of the new songs aren't. But, yeah, like, some stuff, just to get a basic idea down, and then I have to give it to, like, the guy who's doing the video wall programming has to know how to animate stuff. So, like... Now, it's a whole different age, man. Now I'm.
How big rooms do you guys play? Like, I know this Asking Alexander. Is that a UK tour?
So this is US and UK.
Smart. That's a great bill.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. We close, and you know, but the thing is, like, we're both going to get the same amount of time to play, and you know, it's a co-headline tour.
What kind of rooms do you play?
You know, it kind of varies. I think it's going to be a lot of you know, 3 to 5 kind of rooms. You know, and I think that's, you know, for us right now, it's
we come to LA, the Palladium type of thing.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, and we're excited to get back. You know, if nothing else. Tickets have been selling well, but you know, there's that kind of feeling of like, I wonder if people are going to come back. Like, we've been, you know, we've been gone a little while. I wonder how it's going to go.
It's hard. So. We just put a tour up on sale actually today, and I got the numbers, like the first day numbers, and you're like New York and Philly are almost sold out. Like, oh my gosh. But Grand Rapids is in the tank.
Sure.
You know, they always get that. Like, oh, right, like after one day, I'm already pissed off at Grand Rapids and super excited about Philly. And, you know what I mean?
I totally understand.
Because you always wonder, like, okay, is this one going to work? Is this bill going to work? Because for us, too, like, we have the song Judas, which is, I call it the Judas effect. It's taken us to a totally different level. And you can see that instantly in the attendance, in, you know, the amount of merch that you sell. So it's still scary. Like, is the Judas effect still going to be there, or is it over now?
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's still building.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for you, after not being around for 3 years, I'm still wondering, like, is anyone going to give a shit?
It's going to be interesting, man. You know, we're filming a video on just in a few weeks, and that'll come out right about the beginning of the tour. And we're hoping that obviously the record does well and the single does well and all that stuff. But at this point, you know, I'm excited to get out there with the dudes and get on stage. And we've got a really cool show with crazy stuff going on all around
us. Man.
And, you know, it's going to be good.
That's great, man. As we wind down here, what's your favorite song on the record? Is there a couple that stand out for you?
There's a few. I mean, you know, when it's a new record, it's like...
Which one is it today?
Yeah, which one is it today? Because I'm listening to it a lot to prepare for the video, the single Wake Up is really cool. But yeah, so that song is great. You know, there's a song called When They Call My Name, which is out right now on Spotify. People have heard and stuff, and it's on iTunes. It's one of the Instant Grat tracks if you pre-order the record. Mm-hmm. A song called Outsider that's been out for a little while. Like, there's a bunch that are just, you know, it's hard because I listen to our records until they're out, right? This has always been my thing, is that I'll have it in my car, and I can't wait for other people to hear it. And then I feel like once it's out there, it's other people's.
Especially now with the streams and the Spotify, we talked about that. Like, I'm reading, like, sales are good for a record, but the streams are insane.
Yeah.
It's like 10 million streams in, you know, a month and a half or whatever. And it's like, oh my gosh. Like, it's still weird for me when you actually can see those numbers. Because for technology, as shitty as it is for the artist, you know, if this was, you know, 1996, we might have sold 100,000 records by now. But it's not. But to think that 10 million times somebody's listened to these tunes, that's pretty cool. And that's why I'm like, there's light at the end of the tunnel for musicians.
Absolutely.
When you put a new record. It's not just a souvenir. If people are listening and they're consuming and they're getting into it.
There was a time, you know, I would say 2013 was the worst of it. Because even stuff like for us, you know, Hot Topic, which is a big audience, you know, for like people that are kind of younger kids especially, and that was particularly our audience has grown over the years and has gotten older and, you know, kind of matured with the band, but particularly in that time for us, they were going through financial struggles as a company. There was nowhere really for us to put our record. The shelves were being taken out of everywhere. There wasn't this kind of boom in vinyl. There was no Spotify.
No iTunes, you know, or so, like, Apple iTunes media.
Yeah, there was a time where it felt like, oh my, this is over.
Yeah,
and
it's
so
very
for
bleak.
Me, now, I'm excited to see where it's going. You know, we get all kinds of reports about the new songs. There's two songs on Spotify right now that are new songs that people are listening to constantly. And it's just like, if nothing else, I know financially it's not as viable as it used to be, but to know that there's some way to know that people are finding your music, yeah, and it's not just falling into the pit of nowhere, I think it's not as bleak as it used to be, and I'm really excited to see where it goes.
Last question, what's your favorite obscure Kiss song?
So my drinking song used to be what is it? Who Wants to Be Lonely was my drinking song.
Love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love
now
that.
Now I just, for a second, I blanked on it. I don't know why, but I used that. Used to, you know, everybody has like their like get amped up drinking song. It was always Who Wants to Be Lonely. It's such a funny one to choose.
My song at the end of every show when I come back to the dressing room, it's always Tumbling Dice.
Okay.
The Stones.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the Kiss Screws with the Kulick Brothers?
Yeah, I heard it was amazing. I heard their
set
was incredible.
I think
incredible.
I texted you that maybe. Yeah. I was with Brent Fitz on drums and Todd Kern singing. Yeah. Dude, they did Turn on the Night. They did Who Wants to Be Lonely. They did Unholy.
I would love to hear Turn on the Night live.
Oh, my gosh. You got to listen, because Todd Kerns can sing. Like, he plays in Slash's band. And
yeah, sure.
He's another Winnipeg, but dude, he sings better than Miles Kennedy. It's like, dude, he nailed it. That high-ass 80s Paul Stanley screams. So
good.
Good stuff. Does Peter Criss's appearance in the Sure Knows Something video still freak you out?
Oh, yeah. This is like an inside thing. We haven't talked about it.
I don't think we have. We should end off with that.
Yeah.
So in the video.
Yeah. So since I was a little kid, and when I was a little kid, this really started for me, I have been terrified of Peter Criss in the part of the Sure Knows Something video where he is so it's their foreheads and they're doing the Dynasty cover, kind of. Mm-hmm. But like, he has no idea where he is. And there's something... Like, now as an adult, I recognize that he's, like, high out of his mind, right? Yeah. But as a kid, the lifeless eyes. Like, there's no way of qualifying what's going on as a child. So I'm watching it going, like, where is he? Like, what's going on? Because he's not looking at the, like, look it up. You know, if you're listening to this and you're interested in Kiss at all, watch it in a different light. Think of how a child might see this the early 90s on VHS.
How a young Andrew Biersack would feel.
Yeah, still terrified. You send me the GIF image all the time. It freaks me out.
Dude, it's always a pleasure talking
to
you, man. Congratulations. All right, the Black Veil Brides new album, Veil, is out now. And the guys are on the road with Asking Alexandria. They just started their UK tour yesterday, but they're bringing it back to the States February 2nd, starting in Worcester, Massachusetts. Get those tickets at blackveilbrides.com. If you buy your concert ticket on the band's website, you also get a copy of the new album. That's a great value. Win, 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 people. Roll up the rim to win. Roll up the rim to win. Get the new album. Go see Andy and the guys live. You're not going to be disappointed. And speaking of going to see a live show and not being disappointed, Fozzy headed to Europe this week. We're starting our European tour supporting Steel Panther January 28th, this Sunday at the Olympia in Paris. On the 30th, we're in the Mayer Theater in Hamburg. January 31st at Vega in Copenhagen. February 1st, Centrum Scene in Oslo, Norway. That's our Norway debut for Fozzy. February 3rd in Tilburg, Netherlands. February 4th, Oberhausen, Germany. February 6th, Munich, Germany. February 7th, Luxembourg, which is in Luxembourg, of all places. I've never been to Luxembourg before either. Stuttgart, Germany on the 8th. Then we're going to Zurich on the 9th. February 11th, we hit Spain for the first time. Barcelona. February 12th, Madrid, Spain. February 13th, Bilbao, Spain. With Steel Panther. Don't forget all VIPs at FozzyRock.com. Come check us out. Even though we're opening the show with Steel Panther, we're still doing our award-winning VIP. You get to see a meet and greet. You get to do a signing. You get to take pictures with all everybody in the band, including me. I'll be there for sure. And we give you a little bit something special, a little mini concert before the show, playing some songs you're not going to hear later on, a couple fun covers, all that great stuff. And then we return to the United States for the Judas Rising 2018 tour.
with Fozzy, Through Fire, Santa Cruz, Dark Sky Choir. We start February 28th in New Orleans, March 1st in Houston, March 2nd in Dallas, March 3rd in Lubbock, March 4th in El Paso, and then we'll continue on from there. So stay tuned right here to find out where all the dates are. Go to FozzyRock.com to find all the dates. That's just the beginning of the tour. We're going everywhere. We're going to Arizona, California, Nevada. We're going to Oregon, Washington, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Maine, New Hampshire. We're going everywhere, man. So FozzyRock.com. Go check it out and check out all the great Fozzy VIP options that you can do. And also check out all the options on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. We set sail October 27th and as low as $150. Hold your cabin at ChrisJerichoCruise.com, at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. And once you book your cabin, your price includes everything. All right, all the concerts, comedy shows, live podcasts, meet and greets, autograph signings, Sea of Honor tournament, all included with your reservation. You don't pay an extra dime for anything, including food. You'll be able to hang out with everybody on board, including Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Ricky Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Raven, Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms, Beyond the Darkness will be there, Colt Cabana, Mario DeRosa doing the Unprofessional Wrestling Show, Don Callis and Paul Lazenby doing Killing the Town, Brad Williams, Ron Funches, Jim Brewer doing comedy, Jim Brewer doing some rocking with the Loud and Rowdy, a great band that he has, Busted Open will be there, Dave LaGreca, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, Fozzy, of course, The Stir, The Dave Spivak Project, The Darlings of Rock and Roll, The Cherry Bombs, Shoot to Thrill, the world's best AC/DC female cover band, and Blizzard of Ozzy, the best Ozzy cover band in the world, and also Ring of Honor presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches happening in the middle of the ocean, and the winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shot in the future. Young Bucks will be there. The Villain, Marty Scurll, Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Frankie Kazarian, Adam Page, Christopher Daniels, the American Nightmare, Cody, don't call him Rhodes, Cody's wife, Brandy, more to be announced. Big names coming up. And Friday, speaking of big names, Dave Meltzer returns to Talk Is Jericho as we go in in-depth analysis of the breakdown of the Montreal Screwjob. As we do an in-depth analysis of the Montreal Screwjob. It was just over 20 years ago today that that happened. Dave's got a lot of details to share since he covered it and was very much involved. The breakdown between Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Vince McMahon, the end of one stage of the WWE and the beginning of another, the boom period that still lasts to this day, started by the Montreal Screwjob. Very, very intricate set of circumstances to lead to all the stuff that happened. In-depth look and discussion of the Montreal Screwjob 20 years later with Dave Meltzer coming up on Friday. So that's it. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!